Welcome to episode 225 of Red Board Rewind. My name is Spencer Luganbuehl, and today my special guest is former jockey Will Humphrey. Me and Will go over three races from this past Friday and Saturday from the Preakness weekend. Those races were race 13 from Friday and race 12 and 13 from Saturday. And some angles that we discuss are what handicappers can look for when handicapping jockeys, and also why the dinner party may not have been the strongest rendition of the past couple years. This is Red Board Rewind. It's the same old story in this tugboat. We go back and forth. We go back and forth. And it ain't good for me what we do this for. We go back and forth. Won't do this no more. All we want, always have to sell it. 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 All we And now I'd like to welcome in my special guest for this week's edition of Red Board Rewind, something I finally get to get off the bucket list, a former jockey. We're going to be talking with Will Humphrey today. Will, how are you?
I couldn't be better. Thanks, Spencer. I'm a longtime listener of the show, and it's a true honor to be on board.
Oh, appreciate the kind words. Thank you so much. So, like we said, bucket list, having a jockey on, so we're going to kind of, you know, break down the handicapping ideas from the jockey state of mind. But for people who don't know who you are, why don't you kind of give us your background real quick in the racing world?
Yeah, so I was brought up in England. As you can probably tell from my accent, I am English. And my mother trains steeplechasers back over in England. So that's how I got into the racing world. And I ended up venturing away from steeplechasing into the flat side of the game. And then through Graham Motion, came over to America and absolutely loved it over here and ended up staying. I did ride on the flat in England for about 18 months or so. I became pretty soured by it, to be honest with you. It's a very different industry over there, and things weren't going great. So I didn't particularly come over here with the ambition of being a jockey, but one thing led to another. Graham very kindly gave me a couple of rides when I was in Tampa, and I just fell in love with it. So I ended up coming up to Fairhill with him, his base in Fairhill. And then ended up in Laurel, and a lot of help and support from Graham. He helped me find my agent, Simon Purdy, and I rode here for just under 2 years. I rode 100 winners or so, and had a blast doing it. So now it's time for the next chapter of my life, and so I've joined the In the Money team.
Can't ask for a better, you know, pre-race or pre-racing life idea joining us over here in the money. You said you rode 100 winners. I would imagine most of them were over here in the Maryland side, but you said you raced at Tampa. Can you just kind of explain to people, obviously there's differences in every track you go to, but did you kind of have a favorite track compared to a least favorable track? I know obviously with the track configurations and such, it can be, you know, different for different riders.
Yeah, I mean, there was the actual surfaces. Tampa was a very sort of beach sand, and then you go to somewhere like Parks, and it's an entirely different surface. So dirt in itself changes quite a lot. I was very fortunate to ride in Saratoga, which was an amazing experience. I rode quite a lot at Charlestown, Penn National, as I say, Parks, Delaware, Colonial a lot, but I'd say 90% of my riding was done at Laurel. And I guess because that was, you know, that sort of home for me now. So that would have been where I felt most comfortable. I felt that it was funny because I felt very aware of pace and how the track was playing when I was riding at Laurel. And then I would go to somewhere like Charlestown or Penn National, where the surface is slightly different, the configuration of the course in terms of where the you know, how long the stretch is, mm-hmm. is slightly different. When you're running at Charlestown, you're under the lights. And, you know, it seems easy to just go round in an oval on a dirt surface, but it really, it was a real eye-opening experience for someone that's come from England where, you know, we're up, down, left, right, mm-hmm. Majority of the time on the turf to then... And when I was in England, I have to say that I watched American racing. I've always been fascinated by American racing. And on the TV, it sort of seems like the same thing every time. And even when I speak to people back home, you know, they sort of have that impression of American racing. But it's a really different, each track is very different in itself. And it really, you know... It made me realize when I started doing it just how good these top riders are, that they can just go from track to track to track and just nail it every time. I mean, they're unbelievably gifted athletes.
I mean, I would think I would consider you as well, being someone who has ridden a horse, I think, four times in my life, and just knowing how powerful the animals are. And there is a deep admiration for what you guys do every single day, whether you're, you know, you're having a cold, it's obviously a rain kind of day, like you guys get up and down, you know, 6 to 9 times a day to get these rides in. And it's an important craft to have for sure. The other thing I think for me, coming under the tutelage of Graham Motion, I always think of Graham as more of a turf rider. I know you said you had a good idea on pace. Would you say you liked riding on the grass or the dirt more?
To be honest with you, I was certainly more comfortable riding on the turf. You know, I had ridden probably close to, in total as an amateur and an apprentice rider, probably around 200 races on the turf back mm-hmm. home, and being brought up with turf. You know, we don't have dirt over in England. And so when I came here, I certainly felt more comfortable riding on the turf compared to the dirt. But by the time I got to, you know, towards the end of my time race riding, I was comfortable on both surfaces and enjoyed both surfaces. I think for me, the adrenaline rush of riding the turf was stronger. You know, you're racing a lot tighter, and often at times, you know, you're sitting on the home bend and everyone's very, very tight, and you're just waiting for that small gap to mm-hmm. come. And when it does come, and you know, if you've got the horse to punch on through the hole, there's really no feeling like that
going forward. And obviously just having that, you know, analytic mind, obviously being a rider now, working with a bunch of handicappers like us in the money, I obviously always hear people jockey bash on Twitter, oh, terrible ride here, terrible ride there. Are there some instances where just, obviously, people want to lash out and they kind of hold their tongue, but for me, I kind of feel like it's split-second maneuvers of 1 second or not, and if you go inside or outside, that depends on if you win or lose the race. I mean, how important is it, you know, as a rider to just have your horse, quote-unquote, in that right spot, or maybe if the horse isn't responding, just knowing, like, well, I just don't have it today. I'm not going to push the horse any farther than it has to go.
Yeah, I mean, it does frustrate me still to this day when I see people bashing jockeys, because I think, and especially when people, you know, made the odd comment of, oh, you know, he wasn't trying or it was fixed or something. And I think people forget that, you know, if we aren't winning races, our business declines, we're not making a living. And I mean, after you've paid your agent and stuff, if you don't finish in the top three, you know, you come away with $65. And you know, when it's not a 2 minute job, you know, yeah. That's what you see on the TV, but you know, we are up at, you know, 5 o'clock on a horse every morning. You know, probably getting on 7, 8, 9 horses every morning to earn the ride in the race. And so, of course, we want to win. And, you know, it's very easy to sit at home and say, oh, he should have gone for that gap. But, you know, the communication going on between the other jockeys. You know, you're watching what other riders are doing and trying to second guess them the whole time. And you know, sometimes you think, oh, you know, that gap, I'm not sure that's going to open on the inside. I'm better off going around the outside. And then you go around the outside and the gap does open on the inside. And everyone's bashing you saying, oh, why did you do this? Why did you do that? But, you know, you're making a split second decision. And sometimes you're going to get it wrong. And sometimes it's going to cost you the race. But, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's out there to win. Everyone's trying their best. And every decision that is made in a race is done with the intention of achieving the best possible result. Sometimes that doesn't always happen. But, you know, to then go and bash jockeys for doing X, Y, or Z, you know, it does become frustrating.
I think just for me watching, and, you know, obviously being a student of the game, for however many books I've read or races I've watched, you always see the jockey trainer, you know, as a kind of family. As long as you're doing well, everyone's happy. As soon as you're doing bad, you know, it can kind of go sour. Obviously, depending on like certain odds, and, you know, there's certain horses, even on the races we're going to talk about, these horses are 50-1, 30-1. When you're riding those type of long shots, obviously you're still trying to, you know, maybe the trainer's saying if you can hit the board, that's like the ceiling for the horse, and you always try and do better than that. What was it kind of difficult going through certain stretches where it's like, if they could just give me one live horse where the horse is at least going to, you know, pay under $10 to win, I can show them what I'm made of. Because obviously, and I think a lot of people think this, they think that like the jockey can, you know, quote unquote, drag the horse across the finish line a lot of times. And I'm not saying that you guys don't obviously add input with the horses, but I think that the idea of it being that the horse, if the horse is going to race that day, you can't improve his position from ninth to third, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, though I say it myself, you know, one of my strengths and a lot of ways in which I personally received a lot of business and accolades from trainers was the fact that I kept on pumping on these horses. You mm-hmm. know, if I was sixth, I wanted to be fifth, because for me, when I got back into the jocks room and I looked up and I was a 50-1 shot that beat four horses that were shorter prices than me, you know, I took satisfaction in that. But at the end of the day, you know, it is tricky because there were times, you know, when I went 20 rides without a win or something, but, and, you know, people start saying, oh, you know, you can't win a race, you can't do this, you can't do that, and your business starts to drop off a little bit. And at the end of the day, you look back at the horses that you've ridden and they're 20-1, 30-1, 40-1, 50-1. And quite frankly, they were all outrunning their rods. I was giving them good rides, but I just didn't have the horse underneath me. And there were other times where, you know, I went into a weekend and I was loaded, you know, and maybe I had six favorites and three of them won. And, you know, despite the fact that three odds on shots got beaten, three of them won, and everyone just sees, oh, you know, he's had three winners, he's riding really well. Well, I'm not actually riding any differently or any better than I was when I was riding my 20, 50, yeah. 30, 40 one shots, but the horses underneath me were better, yeah. You know, and so it is, it's a tricky game. And sometimes it can be frustrating, but when it goes right, it's very rewarding.
Before we get into these races, I guess if there's like one closing idea that we can put into people's minds before we get into the races, is there a couple key things that you can help handicappers that like, maybe they don't watch a lot of replays, or maybe they're, you know, just getting into the game as beginners, of what they can do to help analyze, you know, jockeys specifically when they're handicapping their races?
That's a good question. Each jockey has their own strengths and their own weaknesses. I think those become less so when you get to the top level, because you find that, you know, the best jockeys ride the best horses, and that's just the way it is. There's little things, you know, particular movements on certain from certain jockeys on certain horses, you know, that maybe as a rider, I can see that that other people particularly don't see. You know, maybe a horse appears to be traveling well, but you know, I can see by the horse's ears and maybe even the, this is going to sound strange, but the angle of the jockey's legs away sure. from the saddle, I can see that he's actually squeezing that horse rather than sitting and just sitting, you know, mm-hmm. which indicates to me that that horse is starting to come under a little bit of pressure when, you know, maybe someone less dialed into that sort of thing would just see the jockey sitting up on the horse and assume that it's traveling well. You also, you know, you're going to get strengths and weaknesses. I think, you know, probably a an obvious one is how strong Flavien Prat is riding the turf. He's equally very capable on the dirt. But, you know, for me, when I am handicapping a race, you know, I pay specific attention to Flavien Prat because he is so exceptional mm-hmm. on the turf, and he might just, you know, have a slight edge over other jockeys and see races unfolding slightly differently. A great example was Fulmineo, his winner on Saturday. You know, he deliberately moved that horse right out into the center of the track because he was very well aware that that was the part of the turf course that hadn't got so chewed up. His horse was going to find it easier to run down the center, and it paid off. And little things like that, you know, I mean, that's where these guys come into their own.
Agree with you so much there. There was an old Saratoga meet that I had where Javier, listen, he's a Hall of Famer. He's a multiple-time winner in Naira, but he was like, I think, 9% overall. But when he broke his stats down, I think he was hitting at like 24% on the turf. And all I did was I passed on him on the dirt races, and I cashed a lot of winners on him that summer on the turf. So I think just seeing, you know, which jockeys are hot, you know, whether it's sprinting, routing, turf, or dirt, I think that can also help out a bunch of people. But, Will, why don't we jump into these three races here that I had you choose. For us, we're going to do a little bit different than we normally do. Usually we do three Saturday races. We're going to add one Friday race into this as well. We're going to start with race number 13 from Pimlico. We're going to go over the grade two Black Eyed Susan, 1 1/8 miles on the dirt. Well, and in this race, this was a little bit of a difficult race for me when I started to go through it. I know I didn't want horses like Corpasso and Recharge. I'm just not a big fan of these horses that are running these slower paced races when they're on the lead. Usually that once they start to get some, you know, other faster horses on the lead with them, they tend to back up and not run as well. The main one I ended up on that I thought was interesting was Call Another Play for Michael Trombetta. Just this one's in excellent form, three straight wins and going, you know, the right way, you know, 40,000 claimer, 62 N1X, and then won a stake. They decided to take a shot in here in this Black Eyed Susan, which I wasn't thinking was the strongest ever grade two type of race. But when we see a horse like this in great form, obviously we get a good price at 8-1. I just thought this one slowly improving was going to be a decent play for me. What were your thoughts here in the Black Eyed Susan, Will?
Well, I think, first of all, I would agree that this probably wasn't the strongest renewal of this race. I didn't particularly like Corposo. I did think that she appeared to stay the distance last time in the Santa Anita Oaks, and she's got a very sprinty pedigree. I was concerned about the distance for her. I liked Call Another Play. I thought I loved her attitude last time when she won a stake at Laurel. My concern with her, though, was that she was running in claiming races only three starts back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on time form in particular, her best speed figure was still 14 points slower than Corposo. And I could see her running into the frame, but could she win it? Probably not for me. I ended up on Recharge. I thought that she had done nothing wrong leading up to the Fantasy Stakes, and in hindsight, you know, an 8 3/4 length defeat to Torpedo Anna now looks very, very good. And behind her that day was My Main Squeeze, who came back to win the eight bells on her next start. So mm-hmm. I thought that she looked like she could maybe get across and clear from the outside post, and she was the one that I landed on.
One horse that me and you didn't bring up, Gunsong, 9-2 with Johnny V on for Mark Hennig. This one took a ton of money in this race, going off at sub 5-2. My thoughts into this was, if you decide that you don't want to look at the Gulfstream Park Oaks and you cross that race out, the 85 and 86 looks very, very dominant in this type of race. But I just don't know what went wrong in that last race. Breakout and bumped at the start, it looks like. Coming from your jockey perspective, you know, how important is it to, like, A, get a clean break? And if you start to get, like, a little bit, you know, of that bumping out of the gate, how much does it take out of a horse?
It can take quite a lot out of a horse, especially with young fillies. You know, they can sometimes lose a bit of confidence there. I agree. I wasn't quite sure what went wrong in that last start. And my issue with her was that the horses that she finished in front of, none of them came back to even hit the board. Mm-hmm. You know, the horses in front of her, they were serious horses. Ways and Means was only just second in that race. But I just felt like there was only four horses really that had a legitimate chance in that race, the Gulfstream Park Oaks, mm-hmm. and she finished fourth of them. I was surprised by how much money she took. But Mark Hennig was very bullish about her, and I think that people were forgiving of that last race, saw an improving horse, and that's why she took a lot of money.
Recharge for Will. For me, I'm going to go with Call Another Play. Or is the public right about Gunsong? Let's see who wins this edition of the Black Eyed Susan right now.
Georgie Mitchell, Black Eyed Susan Stakes. Sharp break for Jean Marie from the rail is going to the front. Call Another Play is also right there, and Gunsong on the outside. Ringy Dingy down to the inside right there too. Corposo racing on the far outside in the clear and only three lengths from the early pace. Who could ask for more? Recharge will be wide into the first turn run. Recharge about three deep around the turn, and trailing is Lemon Muffin. So round the first turn here at Pimlico, Jean Marie shows the way. Jean Marie the closest one in second. Corposo on the outside. Maryland Bred Call Another Play on hold out of the inside. Then in between horses, Who Could Ask For Mo. Recharge is out of the clear third to last at this point, and Ringy Dingy and Lemon Muffin trailing the field. The opening quarter, 24, 1/5 of a second, and it's Jean Marie in charge of the pace, 3/4 of a length from Gunsong in second. Corposo gliding up on the outside into third position with Call Another Play racing in fourth. Who Could Ask For Mo. Ringy Dingy down to the inside. Recharge lingering second to last while still wide of the track there. And last of them all is Lemon Muffin, who's really got a muster rally now. Some seven lengths in that pacemaker. Jean Marie, 1.5 and 49-2. Into the turn with Gunsong right there. Jean Marie, Gunsong head-to-head for the lead. Call Another Play. Ringy Dingy down to the inside of the second flight. On the outside is Corposo, another three. Who Could Ask For Mo. Back to Recharge, and Lemon Muffin is last at the top of the stretch in the 100th running of the Black-Eyed Susan Stakes. Jean Marie now put to the test, followed by Gunsong there on the outside. Gunsong from Jean Marie. Corposo at the center of the track is third. Call Another Play in between horses, followed by Ringy Dingy in the last furlong. And here's Gunsong. Gunsong is strong. Gunsong by three, by four lengths from Corposo, left to battle it out with Call Another Play. It's going to be close for a second, but here's Gunsong in the Georgie Mitchell Black-Eyed Susan Stakes. Corposo was second. Call Another Play. Who Could Ask For Mo and Lemon Muffet?
And it was Gunsong getting the job done. 88, a winning buyer. 660, the winning mutual. I know, Will, you've probably heard the saying that goes through Twitter all the time, but I guess they knew this one as well. Recharge, not sure what happened. Call Another Play, probably hit her ceiling at 9-1 to run third in this race. Corpazzo runs a solid second here. But I think if you forgive that last race, and this horse just looks right in charge there with the 280s before, that kind of fits the play here. Just took too much money for me to really want to put a wager on.
Yeah, I would be of the same opinion. She was a long way the best in this race. Mm-hmm. You could have called her the winner, you know, before they even straightened for the drive. Recharge really went down to her knees out of the break. I was surprised that Rosario maybe didn't make more effort, I guess, to regroup her. And it was just, it was a strange run from her. I don't really know what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt like she could have recovered from that break, got herself into a better position. But quite frankly, she ran too bad to be true, didn't she?
I would say so. And just looking back through the rest of the field and you see, you know, call another play. Who Could Ask for Mo was another one I was kind of enticed in. Lemon Muffin at 9-2 was a little bit of a weird price for me too. Flavian Pratt, one of my favorites, but I think Dwayne Lucas for me is one of those trainers that obviously fantastic back in the day. And I don't think I pay enough attention to him throughout the rest of the year, but when it comes to these, you know, Preakness weekends, I feel like his horses just take a ton of money, whether it's based on Oxbow from back in the day or whatnot. But I mean, the Honeybee was fine. The Fantasy and the Kentucky Oaks were just not good at all. So I'm surprised this horse took, you know, didn't take any money off of a 4-1 morning line, but just what a weird price for a horse that ended up running fifth.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I look back on that Honeybee Stakes and I really still struggle to believe that she won that. To be honest with you, half of me wonders whether, you know, on a day like Black Eyed Susan Day, when probably a lot of people are playing that aren't regular horse players,
mm-hmm.
maybe she took a lot of money just because of her name. You know, Lemon Muffin, you know, I mean, it's sort of like a funny name. I can just see a lot of people fake money coming in for her.
Sure.
The pace wasn't overly strong in this race, and I think that probably aided Corposo, and I probably devalue her second based on that, because she quite frankly had no excuses. I thought going down the backstretch that she could well go on to win, you know, with her sprinting pedigree. So I think going forward, I mean, could I see any of these horses developing into grade one horses? Probably not. As we mentioned before, it was a fairly weak renewal. No disrespect to the winner. She's a very talented horse, but I think she is a grade two horse at best.
I think this is always a good study in where, you know, take a look at who's winning races, take a look at like what their, you know, pre-race ideas are, and then you can kind of figure out how strong a race was in general. But with that, let's move on to the second race of this pod. We're switching to Saturday now. We're still at Pimlico. We're going to go with race number 12, the Grade 3 Dinner Party, 1 1/8 miles on the turf. Will, why don't you start us off with this one?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing to start off with here is the condition of the turf course. We had a wet week. I'm obviously based about 50 miles outside of Pimlico, and we had a lot of rain early in the week, and then through Saturday morning it was just sort of a light drizzle, but that often really gets into the ground more so. So I instantly was looking for horses that I thought were going to handle the conditions, and I had a number of horses that interested me to an extent. Running Bee was one of them. You know, he was good in winning at Keeneland last time. That was a nice race. Masterpiece obviously came out of that race and won a stake next time out. I was interested in Highland Chief actually, and I ended up putting him on top for the reason that last year he jumped his buyer point. His buyer figure up 21 points between his first start off the layoff and second last year. I didn't think he ran a bad race in the Elkhorn, you know, 7 1/4 lengths behind Silver Knot. This looked slightly easier race. I thought he was going to step forward from it, and he had proven himself to handle soft ground when he was racing in Britain. The question with him was, would this distance be too short for him? But I thought that the ground might just make it play like a race that was further than 1 1/8 in itself. I also took a little bit of interest in a tone. You know, he's just a consistent horse. He's always knocking at the top level, and although he doesn't win very often, he always runs his race. And Beatbox as well. You know, he had soft ground form coming into the race. There wasn't really much to knock him on, and Sherry DeVoe was already having a pretty incredible weekend. My main question mark regarding Beatbox was the fact that all his previous races had been run on with the use of Lasix, and would he be able to perform to the same standard now outside of the fairgrounds without the use of Lasix? So I used the Highland Chief on top with then the five underneath and the nine and the four.
I think you bring up such a good point. It keeps coming up now. It seems like every time we talk stake races on this program, just how important, you know, on Lasix, off Lasix is. You almost have to start your entire handicapping process with that, going through each horse in the field. I had four circled in this race, and obviously the one that I was going to go against was Emmanuel, ended up scratching out. So that kind of put a damper in the card a little bit. Beatbox, that soft ground race two back. I love to see that soft ground form, but took so much money in a race that I was just a little bit concerned about how close all of them were. Yes, that can usually put a horse, you know, gives them a little bit of an advantage, but still, I mean, we're talking about sub 2-1 compared to other horses I liked, you know, at 5-1. At 5-1 for both the top choices I ended up going on. Running B, same idea, one that had been improving for Chad. Had those slow-paced races. I didn't know how much, and like you had said before, and we can talk about it more after the race, how the softer the ground, the more the race distance increases than, you know, decreases. The two I ended up on, I just thought a tone, like you had said, such a cool, simple horse. Improved so much going to that Gulfstream Park race three back, then ran the Canadian Turf, then ran at Turfway Park. I just thought this one was just going to be super solid in here. Had races at Pimlico. Definitely wanted to use this one at 5-1. And the one that I actually ended up set my second choice, but I ended up using in a double horse win Dutch, Belichnikov. Phil D'Amato, for me, very, very high on my list of trainers. Ran it in the San Francisco this year, ran it last year. What happened last year? They went to the Shoemaker Mile, too strong of a race. Ended up kind of having the same problems where probably a little bit too far back. Did have a fast pace last year in that Shoemaker Mile. But again, runs really good in the San Francisco this year, and they decide to switch it up. And I think when I'm looking through past performances and I see trainers see something bad happen and they decide to switch it up. And yes, the Shoemaker is obviously a grade one, but now we're showing up on, you know, Preakness Day to run in a race like the Dinner Party. Was my fourth choice overall, but based on the way the odds boards went, I had to include Belichnikov as my second horse in the double win Dutch. So those were my two choices. And for Will, he's going to go with Highland Chief on top. Let's see who gets their dinner here in the Dinner Party right now.
There goes a tone over the early lead. Between horses is Running B. Helms Deep has a narrow lead. Running B and a tone right there down to the inside. And next is Beatbox on the far outside. And here followed by Highland Chief. Crabs and Beers in between horses, already a half dozen off this long shot leader. And then English B racing third to last. And Eons unhurried to the back of the pack. And Belichnikov will have to pace past them all into the first turn run here, where it's Helms Deep. Helms Deep up top goes the opening quarter 26-1 on the soft going, leads it from Highland Chief in second, and Running B on the outside third. A tone is comfortable between horses in fourth. Inside English B, then Beatbox out of the clear, about six lengths in the front in that group of horses. Crabs and Beer, followed by Eons, and Belichnikov last, about 10 from the front. Helms Deep, the one to catch. Helms Deep, with 4.5 furlongs left to go, leads Running B, now a length and a half in front. And on the inside is Highland Chief in third, a tone fourth. Inside there is English B, who's next, and to the outside is Beatbox ahead of the turn. And so Helms Deep, a narrow lead, Running B there on the outside, Highland Chief out of the inside, and a tone is on the move. On the far outside is Beatbox, who's trying to pick up the rhythm into the final turn, the far turn with less than 3/8 to go. And here is Running B, who's come away with the lead. Room for Highland Chief. Highland Chief down on the inside, sneaks right on through the top of the lane. So Highland Chief trying to punch on through. It's running be a narrow lead. Highland Chief swinging outside now is Balnikov, who's come from way back in the pack there. And here's Balnikov out the center of the track. Balnikov is just in front with a furlong left to go. And Frankie Dettori and Balnikov storming home from Crabs and Beer, who's running to second. Is Balnikov. Balnikov to win by two at the dinner party.
And it was Biliknikov getting the job done in a very, very strangely run race. 95, the winning buyer. 1280, the winning mutual. And I know I didn't kind of give you a chance to talk about my horse, Biliknikov, before. But if you want to give a little talk on that, Will, and then we can kind of get into breaking down this race.
Yeah, well, slightly funny because I think Biliknikov was just about the first horse that I tossed out. I look back at his PPs and he hadn't won for over a year. I massively value East Coast turf form over West Coast turf form. And I just look back at his recent races and I see that, you know, he's obviously going to be coming from a long way off the pace, which often can be difficult to do on soft ground because it can just blunt that closing turn of foot. And I look back at his races on the good listed turf over at Santa Anita, and his recent results were a fifth, a sixth, and a eighth, and a seventh on good turf. And just to add to insult, you know, Phil D'Amato, for me, he had a pretty torrid time of things at Keeneland. I mean, you struggle to find his horses with a search warrant. And I couldn't see this horse winning in any way.
Like I said, this is one of those weird races where everyone will say, like, you know, oh, how'd you have this horse? And it's kind of like, I kind of can give my ideas. But at the end of the day, it ends up being the odds board. Like, yes, horses with good, you know, wet or good, you know, soft form will take more money. But at the end of the day, there's still this chance for me, you know, like you had said, D'Amato wasn't that good at Keeneland, but I think that, you know, I took a more of a longer idea of a lens there where I know how good he can be when he's on. He's obviously off a little bit. I will say, I think that the workout too, just kind of showed me that, you know, maybe this one is going to still, you know, be a little bit primed here. D'Amato went for a different spot. And I do 100% agree with you. I think West Coast form much, much worse than East Coast form. But like I said, when you pick four horses and you end up on your third and your fourth, you're not expecting to win too many times. This one paid $1,280. I think this race proves exactly what it was when Crabs and Beer come running second and Running B is third. I think this is just another race where when you look at who hit the board compared to like what could happen, I think that I don't know how many race winners we're going to see coming out of this next time out.
No, and again, as I referenced in our earlier discussions, it was noticeable how Frankie took Balnikov right out into the center of the track, and Crabs and Beer then followed him up the center of the track, and they were finishing, you know, twice as fast as Highland Chief and Running B, who, quite frankly, on the home bend, I was sort of counting my money. It looked like it was those two and no one else. And they turned into the stretch. Both of them stayed down on the rail and it was like they just hit quicksand. Whereas Frankie angled his mount to the center of the course and Castellano followed him on Crabs and Beer and they just kept running. It was a bizarre race, to be honest with you. I mean, V8 sped to the lead, but set very slow fractions, understandably, in the conditions. You know, I mean, they went through the opening quarter in 26-2, but Balnikov was stone cold last. And then, you know, in the blink of an eye, he's suddenly in front. It was a strange race. I think I would actually probably upgrade the performances of the 1 and the 5. Based on the fact that they were noticeably compromised by the part of the track that they were running on. But take nothing away from the winner. I mean, I have no idea where the performance came from particularly, but there seemed to be no fluke about it.
I think when we look back on this race, like I said, we probably won't find a race winner out of this race. And I also think that, you know, not every soft course is made the same. Nobody from Pimlico had really run on this course as far as I could tell back to the PPs. Maybe this is just one where Biliknikov just kind of decided, like, I really feel like running today, enjoyed the Pimlico soft turf. And that's kind of all I can say about that race. But let's move on to the last race of the pod, race number 13. It's the one race that everyone is talking about in their recaps. It's the Grade 1 Preakness, 1 3/16 miles on the dirt. I'll be kind of quick and simple in this. There was only two I really needed in this race. I'm just decidedly going to become a Catching Freedom homer at this point. I thought the Derby was quite good for what it was. Yes, came from very, very far back. Maybe looked a little bit one-paced in there, but I thought still ran a really good figure. Obviously, now with the wet track, you kind of have to think like, okay, Mystic Dan, you know, his best race wasn't a wet track, and then the Kentucky Derby was a perfect trip, but I just wanted to find one other one here. And Tuscan Gold, scratched out of a race I was talking about previously the week before. Chad sends him here. I just love when trainers seem to do that, when they scratch out of a weaker race to go to a, you know, quote-unquote stronger race, or a Triple Crown race for that matter. Those were the two I ended up on. Thoughts from you, Will?
Yeah, I saw this as actually a very open renewal of the Preakness. Mm-hmm. I ended up with Tuscan Gold on top. I love the way that he galloped out in the Louisiana Derby. And, you know, he was racing against a far more experienced Catching Freedom. And you could arguably say that he ran, you know, almost as well as him in his only his third start. He earned a 95 buyer. And again, you know, to achieve that in his third start, I thought was impressive. Obviously, this is a route that Chad Brown has used successfully in the Derby, the Preakness twice now. Mm-hmm. I didn't see a lot wrong with Mystic Dan. I know that he was probably slightly fortunate, taking nothing away from him to win the Derby. You know, he received a dream trip, a fantastic ride to win that day. My problem with him, though, was would he have been the price he was if he hadn't received that trip in the Derby?
Yeah.
You know, I think that I was thinking that he was going to be significantly overbet. And if you ran the Derby again, you know, would he have finished third or maybe even fourth if things had played out slightly differently? So, but again, you know, the wet track obviously gave his chances, increased his chances, and imagination. He was a slightly, you know, taking Californian form and then bringing it over to the East Coast. It can often be quite hard to sort of assess how that squares up. Mm-hmm. But I did see him. I expected him to be on the lead from his outside post. But in the back of my head, I was just sort of thinking, would he be here if Muth wasn't intended to have run? So I ultimately ended up going 8, 5, and 9.
Going for me, like I said, I'm going with Catching Freedom and a little bit of Tuscan Gold. Will also agrees with the Tuscan Gold theory. Let's see if we can get done here in the Preakness right now.
We're off in the Preakness and a great start. Imagination goes to the lead, but sees the gray, wants a piece of the action early. Mystic Dan came away in good order, will settle one off the inside and just steal. Here's Catching Freedom, racing on the inside. Tuscan Gold, third to last, Uncle Heavy and Mugatu. Trails the field as sees the gray down to the rail, leads the way into the first turn here at Pimlico. With Imagination a bit out toward the center of the track on the chase, will now settle back and ready a bit in second spot. Mystic Dan is riding that rail under Brian Hernandez early, and on the outside is Just Steel right alongside. Catching Freedom, 6 lengths on the early pace. Tuscan Gold ridden along as they round that turn and head for the 6 for a long mark. Uncle Heavy, second to last, and Mugatu, the opening quarter, 23 and 4. On this muddy track, as Seize the Gray goes for it up front. Showing the way is Seize the Gray. 5 furlongs out from the line. Leads a length in 3/4. From Imagination in second, Just Steel. Mystic Dan still at the rail, racing in fourth in good striking range. And next is Catching Freedom, who's got 6 to make up, heading over the far turn. Tuscan Gold asks for more. Uncle Heavy and Muga too. But it's Seize the Gray in front, still in front by 3. Mystic Dan rolling up on the inside now. On the outside is Just Steel coming too. And in between Horses Imagination and Catching Freedom also looms large at the top of the stretch with 1/4 to go at Pimlico. And leading the way is Seize the Gray. Seize the Gray trying to lead them all the way. Seize the Gray. And here's Mystic Dan tipping to the outside. Mystic Dan's coming with a run at the 3/16, but still in front of Seize the Gray. Seize the Gray and Jaime Torres in front. Mystic Dan, Brian Hernandez Jr. Catching Freedom on the outside with a late bid. It's Seize the Gray in front by 2, shifting out a little bit under left-handed pressure as they're close to home in the Preakness. Seize the Gray. Oh, Jaime Torres, Seize the Day to win the 149th running of the Preakness.
And it is Seize the Gray getting the job done for good old D-Wayne. Lucas, 100 is the winning buyer, looking at 2160 as the winning mutual. And just going through, and I know we talked about previously, but I mean, this is just what D-Wayne does. I mean, listen, not taking nothing away from the horse. 88's a little bit short on the speed figures there, but the horse was in good form. I mean, when the Pate Mile shows up here, obviously they liked what they had seen. Looking back through and, you know, noticing the wet marks, etc. Mystic Dan runs a really good second. Catching Freedom runs third. I'm starting to think that Catching Freedom is going to become this, you know, underneath board hitter for the entire rest of the summer and the fall. But yeah, I know you brought up Imagination, another one with a nice wet mark that didn't get to run in the wet. But I feel like everyone else in this kind of race had the same type of figures to where he didn't really get an advantage in this. And Bob Baffert finishing second last in a race when obviously he can't race in the Derby. You know, I think my thoughts on Bob are pretty well out there. Happy to see it. Tuscan Gold for me was disappointing in fourth. I thought this horse, I'm going to chalk it up that they just didn't like the track, and then I'm going to bet this one back next time out. But out of the top four, I kind of have really solid ideas and notes and formula going forward.
Yeah, in some ways, I actually left this race with more questions than answers. And yeah. I forgot to say before the race that part of the reason that I was actually strongly interested in Imagination was not only did I think that he was going to be the controlling speed from the outside, but although he hasn't run on a wet track before, his pedigree suggests that he would absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me reason to include him on my ticket. What, Spencer, what was your impression of Frankie's ride on this horse?
I was a little bit shocked is the wrong word. I always look at Frankie 9 out of 10 times to make the right ride, but obviously when this horse is not on the lead out of the gate and Sees the Gray just kind of took it to him, at that point, I would imagine Frankie's now kicking himself because this one went on to win. And I just wonder how heavy that kind of surface was. And obviously you've ridden at Laurel. I would imagine you've ridden at Pimlico as well. Just I've always heard for those Maryland tracks that when you're down on the rail like that, it kind of ends up just being like, you know, a speedway. So I think him not getting on top, I think the horse maybe ended up getting discouraged. I'm not 100%, but I think Frankie would have wished he was in front and not, you know, behind by, you know, a half a length.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a little bit harsh when you look at actually where Imagination finished in the race, but
yeah.
I just found it slightly strange. I mean, he parked the horse 5 wide the whole way around, and you know, young Jaime Torres sort of took a look over at Frankie just after they left the gate and sort of said to him, are you going to go? And he didn't. Frankie sort of proceeded to, you know, strangle Imagination back into second 5 wide, and Jaime Torres was just able to do his own thing on the lead. So, when you look at the actual result and where Imagination finished, did it make a difference? Probably not. There was probably more to it than Frankie's ride, but I just thought it was a strange one.
Mm-hmm.
Full credit to the winner. I mean, my big question with this horse is where has this improvement come from? I mean, his bar speed figures you know, he's improved 18 points in his last two starts. Yeah. And I can't really see where that's come from particularly. Can you?
For me, when I see horses like this, and listen, I'm not going to say I even like this horse at all, but when a horse shows, you know, that small improvement, listen, the 88 was the new buyer top last time out. Now, obviously, is, you know, back-to-back buyer tops. But when they can hold on, you know, from those, you know, fast time form figures in that last race, and they're going, you know, 22-2 to that first half and winning, sometimes that also just shows improvement in horses when they're able to hold on and also win. And, you know, all people see is Dwayne Lucas. And I think that horse going off at 9-1 and winning as well as it did in what was a harsh pace scenario, I think maybe Seas the Gray is just improving right now as not a late developer, but, you know, a lot of times people will see the three-year-olds improve in their first or second start. I think we're just seeing this one improve, you know, maybe third, fourth, and fifth. And this one, I'm not saying, you know, Travers, but I'm just saying this one could be definitely interesting going forward now with that type of buyer that puts him in with the rest of the horses that we thought could win the Kentucky Derby at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was certainly no fluke about this performance. And as you say, he is improving. I guess my worry going into the race was that it just seemed like a last minute swing at the fences from Lucas, yeah, in Lucas type of fashion. He surprised me when he won the Pat Day Mile. I definitely wasn't expecting that, having been beaten, you know, by over 10 lengths in the Bluegrass, mm-hmm, beforehand. But again, as I say, he is an improving horse. And there seemed to be no fluke about it. And if he, which I see no reason why he won't maintain this form, he is certainly going to be a live contender in all of the 3-year-old stakes for the rest of the year. I thought Mystic Dan ran a credible race. Catching Freedom, my worry with him going into this race was that I felt that he didn't get up in time going a mile and a quarter at Churchill Downs.
Yeah.
And now cutting back slightly in trip with a shorter stretch, I couldn't see how he was going to reverse that form. Tuscan Gold, I actually would upgrade his performance, because from the word go, he was clearly hating that track. Yeah. And I mean, Tyler Gaffleon was sort of pumping on him the whole way down the back stretch. And I was actually shocked when they crossed the wire to see him running into fourth. He would be a horse that interests me going forward, and I think that we will probably get a reasonable price on him. And I certainly wouldn't lose faith in him.
It's good that you say that. I'll probably add that note as well. Me and Will also agree with Tuscan Gold. I will say this with Seize the Gray, just for people, you know, who, you know, this one's from Arrogate, 50,000 stud fee. They paid 300,000, so obviously they paid more than the stud fee. This one's already made 600,000, so good horse, bad horse. But I just think when you look through, you know, obviously, you know, ran third in the Skidmore on a muddy track. Like, this one I think has just one of those spots where it's one of those horses that you don't talk about all the time, but when it runs in the PPs and beats, you're like, all right, this horse has run some incredible races. I know the improvement now has happened in back-to-back races, but I'll say it kind of just how I thought about the Black Eyed Susan. This is not, you know, your quote-unquote grade two race. Mood scratched out. You know, if you look through, Imagination has a win in a grade two. Just Steel, you know, won the Eddie Brown. There's not a lot of multiple grade two winners in this race, so I'm not going to say that, you know, I'm not going to, you know, harp and say that the race wasn't good, but I'm just going to say I want to see these horses in 3-4 months' time with a couple more, you know, graded stakes under their belts and see where they all end up. But I think overall,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree with you completely. Now, I think it's going to be really interesting to see which way these individual horses are going to develop going forward. I mean, you know, Will Catching Freedom, he's run three consecutive 97 bar speed figures. Is that his ceiling, or is he going to break through and suddenly jump up? You know, there aren't many races going any further than this, but he constantly shakes as if he wants he wants more distance underneath him. Mystic Dan, again, you know, he's at the top of his game right now. Is he going to be able to carry that form forward? Same question mark with Seize the Grey and Tuscan Gold. Personally, you know, I would be inclined to give him another shot going forward, but ultimately, you know, he finished fourth, and he, you know, is that as good as he is? Often, you know, these top-notch horses can cope with any condition, you know, be it wet or a fast track.
Yeah.
So is he going to break through into that top level? Obviously, by the time they get round to the Belmont, I haven't heard whether he is going to go to the Belmont, but, you know, you're going to have Sierra Leone, Fierceness, when the heavy hitters come back in 3 weeks' time, how will these horses square up?
I feel like this weekend has left more answers, or left more questions than answers, I'll say that. But with those final comments, I do want to thank my special guest, Will Humphrey, for coming on, talking all things over at Pimlico, also giving us some background on some jockey thoughts and ideas. And I know, Will, sometimes you're doing some work for Pete over here in the money. Kind of tell people what you have down the pipeline coming in for us.
Yeah, I'm still pretty new to this side of the industry. I finished riding races at the end of last year, and so I'm just still a relative newbie. But I'm loving doing some ridding content over in the Money Media, sort of doing spot plays and horses to follow at the weekends, and then some eye catchers and takeaways early on in the week from those past weekends, and just sort of trying to build a bit of a CV, develop my craft, and hopefully provide some good content.
CV, such a better word than resume. I'll stick to that until the day I die. But thank you so much, Will, for coming aboard, and I'm sure we will be talking again sooner rather than later.
It was a pleasure, Spencer. Thank you very much.
I want to thank everyone who listens to this show and the rest of the shows on the Money Media Network. Also want to thank my special guest, Will Humphrey, for coming on, talking all things at Preakness Weekend with myself. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's president is Peter Thomas Florentel. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin, and our In the Money Media business manager is Drew Coatney. I'm Spencer Luganbuehl. We will see you next time.